I need somebody help. Not just anybody help. You know I need someone help. When I was younger, so much younger than today, I never needed anybody's help in any way. Now these days are gone, I'm not so self-assured. Now I find a change of mind and open up the doors.
I'm Beattie Cohn-Vredos, and welcome again to Ask Beattie. And I want you to take the Beatles song very, very seriously and take it in, because we all go through a lot of ups and downs in our life. And believe it or not, therapists are not immune from the challenges of life. But the real question is that when we're having challenges, as we all do, whether or not it is the depression that has been going on for a long, long time, or the anxiety that you've been experiencing, you're waking up most mornings and you're having panic attacks, or you're having headaches and you're just feeling really anxious and you're not exactly sure what it's all about. But my question to you, of course, is what are you going to do about it? Or the new depression, or the old depression. You've had some bad times currently, and you've been exercising and trying to sleep well and eat well, and yet your mood is just not moving up. So again, what are your options? You can sit and you can wallow. You can wallow in your pain for months and weeks and years. In fact, it is so interesting that the majority of patients who call me, invariably they'll say, Beattie, we really wished we had called you. And many of them have said, called you 10 years, 15 years ago, 25 years ago. So the reality is that we don't need to suffer alone. And I think it is a really, really positive thing that we're hearing more in the media about mental health and addictions of various different kinds. And what I try to do every week on the Ask Beattie show is to really to motivate, to inspire you to really begin today. And today is as good day as any day. We can't change anything that happened yesterday or a week ago or even 30 seconds ago, to take some action today to acknowledge and address and resolve as best as we can your issues, so that you are then able to really and truly move forward with your life. And of course, this action, trust me, it really changes. It changes your relationships and it changes the quality of your life forever. And as you all know, today is show 196 here on the Progressive Radio Network. For those of you who want to call in and you may have some questions, and of course we can discuss, we can debate, the call-in number here is 888-874-4888. You know, one of the things that I was really thinking about over the weekend is the importance of, you know, when you think about it, it is almost the end of the year. And I don't know whether or not it's just that I'm getting older. I mean, I feel like I'm 20 years old, but I mean, there is a reality here, and the years are really going by so, so quickly. And I always ask people at the end of the year, as we're approaching a new year, to really evaluate where you are at. And I'm going to ask you this now. We're a few days before Thanksgiving and Christmas and Hanukkah, just a few weeks away. So take a look and ask yourself a couple of really important questions. And question number one is that am I in a place in my life where I'm really feeling good, mostly good about my life and my relationships and my work? And I want you to ponder that and, you know, put away the cell phone and the computer for a couple of moments and really be honest and serious with yourself. And if you're not, after you go through the process, the honest process of self-analysis, again, what are you planning to do about it? And, another thing that I always, always want you to really ponder are the people in your life. I mean, for me, and those of you who've been listening to me for the last many, many years, you know that I have a zero toxic policy so that there are zero toxic people in my life. And I tell you, that is a really, really good way to live. But what about in your life? If you look at your family relationships, if you look at your collegial relationships, if you look at friendships, how are those relationships? Are they relationships that really nurture you and support you? Are they relationships that for the most part make you feel crazy and make you feel really, really badly about yourself? And especially if you're dealing with family and toxic family and dysfunctional family relationships, it's really, really hard to extricate yourself from these close, in quotes, intimate kinds of relationships. And yet, you know, what I try to get people to do all the time, because I'm all about problem solution. So you try, you really try, you try to discuss, you try to talk, you try to negotiate, you try to compromise, you try to make trade-offs, you try to come up with a win-win resolution. But what happens if that is not happening for you? Then what are you planning to do? Because one of the number one issues that makes us not only mentally crazy, but physically sick is engaging in toxic and dysfunctional relationships with people. So again, I want you to be honest with yourself, and I want you to evaluate not only your life and your work and your lifestyle, but also the people who you are dealing with on a day-to-day basis. And that includes your partners, and that includes your spouses, and that includes your young children and your old children. Of course, you're not going to be extricating and tossing away your young children. But again, it's about really, really taking an honest, honest look systemically at your life. And it is amazing how a few changes, and I'm not suggesting that these changes are necessarily going to be easy, can make all the difference in the world. So what do you think about all of that? And are there changes that right now, because I know that there are a lot of people listening to the show right now, I want to know whether you are one of these people who's sitting back and saying, I think maybe today is the day that I am going to talk to, whether or not it's my mother, my father, my brother, my sister, my boss, my lover, my husband, my partner, about things that are not working for me. And a lot of people believe, and I wish it were true, but it doesn't work out, that we can just bury these issues. We can put things under the carpet. We can put them in a drawer and somehow miraculously, everything is going to turn out okay. And that rarely, if ever, happens. So again, it is about acknowledging, addressing, resolving as best as you can the issues that are getting in the way of your life and your relationship. But as the Beatles tell us, you don't need to do this alone. We all need coaches. I mean, those of you know that I have spent my entire life competing in the national world of tennis and in other sports in Canada, and I could not have done it without a coach. I mean, we all need coaches. So if you're finding that it is not working on your own, there are therapists, there are social service agencies, there are classes, there are books, there are courses, there are a number of different things that you can begin to do today to change the quality of your life and the quality of your relationships. Well, today I have a guest. A guest who I met a couple of years ago at a networking group here in New York City. Her name is Rachel Braun-Sherrill, and I'm really, really happy, Rachel, that we're finally connecting after, well, it's almost 3 years.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And Rachel has a long record of success as a growth strategist, marketing expert, and vagipreneur, and I'm dying to find out what a vagipreneur does. And Rachel was co-founder and president of Sempre Laboratories, Incorporated, a venture-backed company focused on developing and marketing women's sexual health products. And as you probably know, Rachel, we are not doing well in the bedroom in the United States. I mean, right?
Absolutely. It's a bold statement that you made, but one of the primary issues that I focused on a lot as a vagipreneur, which is a person in the business of female health, is really having a language and a vocabulary to communicate with one another. So the example that I often give is we're 20 years into a world with Viagra and bigger, longer, stronger and 4-hour erections, and I've spoken to thousands of women through quantitative and qualitative research and conversations, and I've yet to find a woman who thinks of sexual intimacy as a performance activity. So the adjectives just don't work for her. You know, the other way to test how different we are in terms of our communication is often I'll start a conversation and in front of a group of men and women and say, raise your hand if you're looking for a partner with a 4-hour erection, you know, which is language that we all know. It's
yes.
Part of the common dialogue and conversation because of all the money that's been spent behind these ideas. And that's not to bash the erectile dysfunction drugs. It's just to suggest that it reinforces the fact that we really don't have a language that works for the spectrum of female sexuality, which, as we're learning, is becoming more and more fluid.
You know, it's really true. And, you know, I cite a study that you may very well be familiar with. This was a study done at the Western Pittsburgh Psychiatric Institute. But these were not people, at least on a conscious level, Rachel, who were involved in a psychiatric study. These were, again, on the surface, these were people, 100 couples who considered their marriages to be very happy or happy, okay? Much better than the majority of people who you will ask about their marriages, where we have an almost 50% divorce rate for first marriages, a 63% divorce rate for second marriages, and a 72% divorce rate for third marriages. So what did we find, or what did they find with this very happy and happy couple situation? Well, 50% of the women had difficulty becoming aroused. An additional 35% of these women had difficulty experiencing orgasm. 15% could not experience orgasm under any circumstances at all. With the men, there was a 50% statistic with regards to premature ejaculation. I mean, that's really, really high. 50%. Some of the studies said a third. Some of the studies said up to 50%. And with erectile dysfunction, 52% of men between the ages of 40 and 70 had issues with their penises when it came to their ability to maintain and sustain an erection. So if this is what's going on, right?
Well, there's so many issues. Just to address some of the statistics that you spoke about from the study, there is what we call an orgasm gap. So there are about a third of women who never experience an orgasm of any kind, which to me is somewhat tragic. But the gap comes with when they do research to say to a male partner, you know, did your partner have an orgasm? Almost 90% of the time, they're sure she did. In reality, it's almost two-thirds of the time that she did. So there's a huge gap of about 20% where he thinks she's satisfied and she isn't.
Right.
The other study that I've seen quoted quite frequently is the percentage of time that he has an orgasm is way over 90.
Yes.
And hers is somewhere between 20 and 30. So let's start with that physiologically, women are much more complex and their female sexual response system is physiologically much more complex. And then you add in the many, many causes that affect women of all ages in terms of their sexual satisfaction.
Absolutely.
So hormonal changes. That's right. Not just menopause. It's right. After pregnancy. Obesity, which is an epidemic. Diabetes, the side effects of medication. The one that has always struck me as the most ironic is that oral contraceptives are known in some cases to lower your libido.
Right.
So in this twist where you can have sex without fear of becoming pregnant, you might not even be interested in having sex. Stress, which obviously is not age specific, and the side effects of cancer treatment.
Right.
So there's literally many, many systemic causes for women's experience changing. Some of it is relationship, but, you know, we always joke, good sex happens to bad relationships, and bad relationships often result in good sex. So who knows? I mean, it's not a linear process when it comes to women and their sexual response.
No, absolutely right. And of course, you know, beginning with oneself, I mean, I talk about if you're going to have a good relationship, sexual or any other kind of a relationship with anybody, that we each have to be in a good place emotionally, psychologically, psychiatrically. And we're looking at rates of anxiety and depression, so that if people are feeling depressed and anxious and stressed, and they have a lot of untreated psychological, psychiatric, you know, emotional kinds of issues.
And then they might also be having some physiological issues
exactly.
beyond their control.
Exactly. Including, you know, sexual harassment, early child sexual abuse. I mean, we're hearing all of these kinds of things that we don't pay sufficient attention to at all. And of course, if your relationship also is not in a good place, and you couple that with all of the things that you're saying, including stress, especially, I mean, here in New York, I mean, I will joke with women, I mean, not even my patients, but people who I know, and it's like, there's no time for sex. I mean, we're working 24 hours a day. People are emailing in the middle of the night. So plus the hormones, plus the sexual side effects of over-the-counter medications and prescription medications, of course, including, you know, antidepressant medications. I mean, there's one medication, and that is Wellbutrin, and I'm not prescribing people who are listening to the show right now, that has the fewest sexual side effects. So you're looking at all these other medications.
So it's sort of miraculous when you lay this all out that actually anybody's having sex that they enjoy.
Right. Well, did you hear also the study looking at, again, frequency? We don't care so much about frequency. It's more the quality, I think, and most certainly women would agree to that. But in France, guess, Rachel, how often do couples have sex in France?
Regardless of how happy they describe their relationship.
Well, you don't have to think about any of that.
Just three times a week.
Okay, 2.2 times a week. In the United States.
The statistic I've always heard is on average once a week. And when I say that statistic, and I'd love to hear what yours is, I get one of two responses. That much or that little, yeah. And it's very specific to your age and your interests and a whole bunch of other things.
And the statistic, the real statistic from the latest study, is a little bit less than two times a month. So there is a gap, and you're right. You know, somebody will say once a week, oh my God, that is so much. And, but we're not in this, certainly in this country, in the large cities. I mean, we're focused on work. We're focused on our kids. We're focused on all kinds of other things. And what I find, you know, as a psychotherapist and a sex therapist, that ourselves, our relationships, our sex lives are oftentimes really, really placed on the back burner. And then we wonder why are we not doing better in the bedroom as well as out of the bedroom.
And I also think when you talk about doing well in the bedroom, many women from all the work that I've done with companies and with women, there's no consistent definition of what satisfaction is.
Right.
So if you asked 100 women what's satisfying, some will say orgasm, some will say intimacy, some will say
right.
closeness, some
right.
will say snuggling, whatever it is. If you ask 100 men, they likely say orgasm.
Oh,
so
absolutely.
The experiences are quite different. You mentioned just dozens of distractions we have as a society. I know you spend a lot of time with your patients on self-care and self-awareness. When you put all these things together, what we're creating is what sounds like an almost impossible scenario for people to be enjoying their sex lives. But the good news is there are people who are. There are people who make it a priority. And there are a lot of products and services that I've worked on that other people are creating to try to give women more options to improve almost any aspect of their, what I would call their sexual health and wellness. So not just arousal and satisfaction, but actually how they feel and the health of their body, lubrication, hormonal balances, whatever the case may be. There's a thousand different ways to approach a woman's health. And what I see now with the companies that are being developed is they're looking at women more completely. They're not saying, well, she's just a menopausal woman, let's find a solution for her.
Right.
Or she's just a young mother, let's find a solution for her. But looking really at the complexity and the totality of women's lives.
You know, it's so interesting. Again, I'm Canadian, and I still think we're a kinder, gentler, more liberal, more sexual, more, you know, country in all kinds of ways. And in my practice, and the majority of people who call me, they're not calling for sex therapy. I mean, 25% of the people who I treat have significant psychiatric issues. And, you know, so I treat people who have depression, anxiety. I do a lot of couples therapy. And of course, you know, if you're doing this kind of work, you better know something about sexuality. And what I find, Rachel, is even with the younger women and men, that people are pretty, pretty uptight about sex and about talking about sex. And, you know, when I think about, you know, my own sex life, and thank God, you know, Jim and I, we resonate very well in and out of the bedroom. But nobody has ever, ever asked me, my gynecologist, my primary care doctor, nobody has ever said, Beatty, how is your sex life or what is it like? And this was, you know, premenopausal, postmenopausal. The question has never been raised.
It's very, very disturbing. The statistics that I've seen is only 3 to 5% of obstetricians and gynecologists ever ask about sexual satisfaction.
Right.
That doesn't mean that they're irresponsible. They're asking about disease prevention, fertility, infertility, menopause, pregnancy, menstruation, whatever the case may be. But historically, at least in my work, one of the reasons they're not asking that question is they haven't had many options to offer patients. So let's say you do ask, maybe the doctor does ask his or her patient, are you enjoying it? And she could say no, but he doesn't have much to do for her. There haven't been a lot of options historically. And we haven't, again, even the physicians often don't have the vocabulary to talk about what the options are or even diagnose what the problem is.
Exactly. And, of course, in 15-minute visits, it is very difficult to talk about anything other than, in quotes, the presenting problem. You know, I had a urologist on the show a couple of years ago, and there was a big study, I think it was with 2,500 men, who had literally, Rachel, just coming, you know, from seeing their urologist. And then they were asked, did the subject of sex come up in your discussion with your urologist? And the majority said, absolutely not. So here were men. They had urological issues. Maybe they had prostate cancer. Maybe they had other things going on. But how is your sex life? It's still a taboo subject.
And it's much less taboo in a situation where a man is talking to his physician. And all you have to do is look at the sales of Viagra and Levitra and Cialis to know somebody's having conversations about it.
Well, they're asking for prescriptions. I'm not so sure about the conversations, but they're asking for prescriptions.
So at least that's a start. I'm not suggesting, that's sufficient. But one of the other issues that brings up, because there are disparities in all kinds of things, and I do think the conversation happens more often with men than with women. It might be not happening enough for either gender. But that now that if you're just talking about erectile dysfunction, which is just one of many problems that a man or a couple can experience, he now has a solution. So as they say, he's ready for action. The male sexual response works like a hydraulic pump. You pump the blood in. Viagra and all those drugs work as vasodilators. They pump up the system, and he's ready for action. Nothing has changed for his partner in that scenario. In this case,
That's
when I'm talking about a heterosexual partner, she's in the same position she was. She might still have dryness. She might still have the side effects from medication. She might have the whole host of issues, and their relationship might be terrible. I don't think we should spend all of our time saying, well, if you fix the relationship, everything would be better, because
Absolutely.
That's clearly not the case.
Yes.
But there are a whole host of issues that interfere. I think the advent of solutions for erectile dysfunction for men in certain way exacerbates the problem for women who are in relationships with a partner who maybe is fixed, in quotes. They have a solution to their problem, and she's in the same place she was before.
And I think also, I agree with you totally, that just being able as a couple to discuss sex is very, very difficult for the majority of people. And I'm seeing that with the younger couples, you know, as well as with the older couples. You know, I tell the story about my Sarasota, a couple of my two favorite Sarasota women patients, who were in their 80s. And they were having much more sex, however they were doing it, and with whomever they were doing it, than many, many people that I was working with that were in their 30s and 40s, and they were freed up. They gave themselves permission to do whatever it is they needed to do, including masturbation, including finding younger guys, including whatever it was, because they did not want to give up that part of themselves, you know, and it was very exhilarating for me to see. Of course, we know what's going on with STDs in the assisted living facilities
right.
around this
it's
country.
An epidemic.
But you know what? Yeah, they have to take care of themselves medically, but you know, the people are having fun. They are really, really having fun.
It is quite concerning when you say that even with the younger population, there's still a real discomfort and a lack of vocabulary and ability to discuss. And when you look at the statistics, and we've eliminated, whether you're for or against sex education, it's been eliminated in, you know, more than half of the states in the U.S. And there's a whole generation of young people whose sex education is limited to porn that they see on the internet.
Right.
I think we're in our new world with technology replacing a lot of conversations. We're making the problem worse. One of the studies that I've seen that I find particularly disturbing, and it relates to something you said earlier, is there's evidence to suggest that young women and girls who are not taught the right names for body parts and don't know how to speak of their genitals with the right description and don't know how everything works, that they are less likely to report instances of sexual abuse or violence.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
to me, that raises the issue to a whole nother level. Obviously, enjoyment is important, but at a minimum, we should be doing a much better job in giving girls and boys the language and the vocabulary to know what their body parts are, to know how they work, to know what their options are, to understand what they feel comfortable with and don't feel comfortable with.
It's true. And as you say, there is little, if any, sex education in the American school system. We did much better in Canada when I was living in Canada. But I am concerned to see, because in my practice, again, these are not people who are coming for sex therapy. These are people who are there either for relationship issues or other mental health issues, that sexually, things are not really going all that well. And I'm thinking specifically of three couples in their late 20s, successful in their professions. Yes, there are relationship issues, and there may be hormone issues, and there may be some other things. But that the language, as you say, of course, for me, it boils down to not just a sexual language, but people's ability or inability to communicate and problem solve. To say, listen, I don't like the way you're touching me, or better still, you know, I love it when you touch me like this,
right.
And I need more time. People don't have that language. We've never taught them, you know, so it's kind of hit and miss. And I think, you know, what's been happening, and tell me what you think about this, Rachel, with the, you know, the virtual sex. We're moving into a whole different world where you can have virtual sex and never have to be with anybody real and do whatever it is you want to do and say whatever it is you want to say and have your orgasms or not.
Yeah, it's complicated. And I'll start with anything that a consenting adult wants to do by him or herself or with a partner is fine. But I do think that the communication or lack of, whether it's about the relationship, whether it's about what you find pleasurable, whether it's about what you want or don't want, we're not teaching people. I'm not suggesting 50 years ago we were great at it either.
Right. For sure not.
But now we're substituting even the promise of a conversation with, you know, virtual sex or robots or porn or whatever it is. And again, whatever consulting adults want to do is fine. But I get concerned that we're raising a whole generation of people who don't speak in complete sentences, who don't communicate
right.
On anything other than text. And I have to believe that that's going to have a long-term and negative impact on the productivity and the happiness of our relationships.
I think that that's absolutely true. And the younger people that I treat, who are all very well educated and, quote, successful in their careers, et cetera,
and have the luxury of being able to afford therapy.
Right. That's true. And they're saying exactly the same thing. I mean, I have young women in their late 20s, literally, who sleep with their phones. Now, this was something that I just heard about very, very recently. So here's the deal. They find a guy that they think that they like. They may have hooked up, and the hooking up business is very, very rampant. And then these young women, and I'll get calls from college co-eds around the country, and they'll say, "Beatty, we know you're a relationship expert, a sex therapist. We don't understand this. We hooked up with this guy. I thought he liked me. I really liked him, and he didn't care if I had an orgasm or not." And I said to them, "Honey, why would he care? You didn't know each other. Why would he actually care to take the time to make sure that you were going to have an orgasm and it was a hookup?" And it's like, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. But the young women, they're sleeping with their phones. They're waiting to see whether their likes are responded to. I'm thinking of one woman in particular right now. She's sleep deprived. You know, she works for a big corporation here in New York City. And I mean, things are, I think, and I don't think it's our generation. I think that things are really out of whack and people don't speak. They text and you lose the emotionality and the quality of any real communication when you're using 140 characters or something, or something like that. But the good news, as you say, I want to hear about the good news. Product news, education news that you are in the midst of.
So there are a lot of amazing people starting companies to address parts of this big complicated world called female sexual health and wellness. So from the functional, there are a lot of new products that are being developed for menstruation that maybe are made out of different kinds of materials that are more comfortable or that are sourced differently or that you're able to get in the privacy of your own home more easily. There are a lot of, especially young women, starting these companies who are thinking about building these companies not just as product companies but mission-based companies. So, for instance, a company that I'm thinking of that has a line of tampons and condoms and lubricants, I ask the question, are they a female products company or are they a mission-driven company that happens to sell products?
Uh-huh.
And the answer is it might not matter, but they're so focused on doing good and making women especially aware of their sexual health and the options that they should take to protect their sexual health. They happen to sell products, but their mission and their communication and the way they speak is very, very different than we've been speaking to women in the past when we're dealing with things like menstruation, which is not even a problem. It's a reality that many women have. It's part of being a woman. It's part of being able to be fertile at some point in the future. The conversations are different. The materials that they're using in the products are different. The language that they use to speak to women are different. So there are a whole bunch of women focusing on developing products for menstruation, products for fertility, understanding
yes.
how complicated that is. And for a whole bunch of reasons, there are a lot of women with issues with fertility, which is not new news. There are so many men with issues with fertility. One
yes.
of the things with one of the companies I'm working with that I recently heard is that they spend a lot of time, a lot of these companies and a lot of these physicians spend a lot of time assuming that it's the woman with fertility issues
mm-hmm.
where if you had tested the man mm-hmm. earlier on, you might have saved yourself a lot of time, money, and aggravation. There are women coming up with new kinds of pregnancy tests that are sustainable because they were concerned that something like 3 million pounds of waste that are the result of pieces of pregnancy test kits being in landfills. So they've come up with a way that you can have sustainable, flushable pregnancy kits. Now, what's unique about that? There's a whole generation of people who care a lot about what they're doing to the environment and
right.
the impact they're having. The second really interesting issue is for the 13-year-olds who, whether we like it or not, some of them are sexually active.
Absolutely.
If she is taking a pregnancy test, she can do it discreetly. For the woman who's aggressively trying to get pregnant, she doesn't have to have a reminder in the garbage can that yet again this month she failed to get pregnant. Mm-hmm. So there are variations on the theme of products and solutions that we've provided that all have interesting twists.
Now, why are we not hearing? I mean, I haven't heard anything in the media. I mean, I look at the commercials as little as possible. But, you know, you of course you're hearing about the Viagra, the Cialis, etc. But why aren't we hearing about any of this? This is good news.
It's a complex question that has a complex set of answers. So one of the primary issues that businesses in this space struggle with, and that I certainly experienced when I was raising money the first time for a product in this space, is that there's a real discomfort with anything around female sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
I raise money with my business partner, and you can't imagine the conversations that you hear, the responses that you get.
From whom?
From venture capitalists when you're talking about raising money. So the first issue is it's harder to raise money for women in general. And then certainly when you're focusing about something in the area of female health, reproduction, wellness, sexuality, there's a, you know, a generally bigger level of discomfort. You know, there's this very interesting new approach to nursing, a new nursing device. And the story that was in the news that one of these entrepreneurs was talking about is a venture capitalist, a potential investor, actually said, ooh, the nipple, gross. I don't want to talk about that.
Uh-huh.
So one big challenge is raising money and having access to capital and access to the networks that come with the capital. The second is there are lots of media barriers. So, for instance, I was dealing with a woman who has a successful book and a business, and she has a book that's selling well that has the title Sex in It.
Uh-huh.
She's selling it on Amazon. It's doing very well. She can't advertise it on Facebook. I've spoken to other companies where they're in the area of menstruation. You can advertise on Facebook if you say cycle, but not if you say period.
Interesting.
So there are all these systemic barriers and media barriers that prevent the message from getting out in a direct and straightforward way. When we were building our company, we went to over 100 outlets, whether that was TV, cable, network, radio, websites, 95% of them said no. And when I say that, I mean to say we would say we have money to advertise our clinically approved, safe, effective, hormone-free product that helps women with arousal, desire, and satisfaction. And they would say, no thanks, we don't want your money.
I mean, that's, I find that absolutely, absolutely fascinating. I mean, since certainly for big corporations, I mean, one would think it is always about the bottom line. It's like, who cares about the ethics? Who cares about the product? So they sent you away.
And I'm not the only company. They've sent lots of companies away. We were having this problem starting 8 years ago, and it still continues today with a lot of these companies that I'm working with. So the content is considered to violate whatever standards they have. One of the challenges that I have with this that gets me a little bit crazy sometimes is on any given day, you can go on Facebook and you can find pages about, you know, pedophilia.
Garbage. Yes.
About
right.
People doing violence to other people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is there... Just to have a blanket policy that says if you mention sex, if you mention vaginas, if you mention nipples, you know, we're not comfortable. The other thing that happens in this conversation is that when you go to male venture capitalists, which, as we know, way more than the majority are, they have they often say this is a niche business.
Uh-huh.
Now, I don't know how it could be niche if it's worth billions of dollars. I don't know how it could be niche if it's 50% of the population. But the way they look at raising money behind these businesses is just different. So when you go back to your initial question, why don't I hear about it? There are a number of reasons.
They're not being advertised.
They're not being capitalized
uh-huh.
In the same way. But I have to say, every day I'm more and more elated with the progress that many of these companies are making. They're breaking through. They're making noise. They're getting people's attention. They're using creative strategies to get around the barriers that they're facing.
So product-wise, tell us what are some of the best and newest and latest, even though we may not have known anything about them or hear about them, products that are out in the market for women's sexuality. What are they?
So there are a number of products, new lubricants, new approaches that have different ingredients. There's a whole movement in the country right now that you don't need to label in great detail the ingredients in products that women insert vaginally, which
right.
seems crazy. So there are a whole group of women who are looking at different aspects of this and coming up with products that are truly organic, that are truly natural, that are truly preservative-free, that women can use for cleansing, that they could use for lubrication, that they could use for any number of issues. So there's a whole new ingredient approach, so to get rid of some of the allergens. What's interesting about a lot of the companies that I see is the women or men who started them did them to solve a particular problem that they had, and then they realized that lots of other people had it as well.
Of course.
There are companies who are taking new approaches to incontinence. So there are a lot of different solutions that doctors and women try for incontinence. But every day I hear about a new company that either has a new approach to a device that can strengthen the pelvic floor muscles or products that you can use at home as opposed to having to have surgery, which is the most extreme
right.
solution for incontinence. Mm-hmm. There are interesting companies that have come up with new models mm-hmm. about how to fit you for a bra.
Yes, yes. I think that's terrific. I mean, I've actually seen some new advertising on television, and I want to try it myself, where they talk about the perfect fit. Since so many of the bras that, you know, we purchase in stores, it doesn't matter whether you're fitted or not. The fit is imperfect somehow.
Well, and part of it is, if you think about it, it seems very logical. We acknowledge that we all come in different shapes and sizes, mm-hmm. but you have to wear a bra that's either 32, 34, 36, 38, and we have a couple of different cup sizes.
Yeah.
A lot of the companies are around taking more measurements, so it's much more customized for yourself. A lot of the businesses that I see are about building personal relationships before you sell things, whether it's a bra, whether it's sex toys, whether it's pleasure kits, yes. whether it's new kinds of lingerie, whether it's a medical solution to something. So there are literally dozens for, I mentioned to you earlier, I'm working on a book that I'm hoping will be out first quarter of next year called Orgasmic Leadership, in which I've interviewed over 36 entrepreneurs in different spaces who are creating companies that are innovative in many ways, but in broad categories. They're innovative in terms of their social impact. So there's a brilliant woman who comes from India, was educated in the U.S., and where menstruation and sanitation is a big problem. So not only is she coming up with new product solutions, she's created a business model whereby the women who need them are manufacturing them and selling them. So they have solutions for themselves, and they have an economic engine to support themselves.
And we have a caller here from New Jersey. Hello, welcome to the Ask Beauty Show with my guest, Rachel Sherrill. Hello? Hello, hello.
You're on, Lisa.
Lisa? You see, it takes a conversation about sex frequently to get my listeners to actually dial in and dial in. But no, it's so true, though, Rachel, that people still, you know, regardless of all the advertising that we do see all over, to be able to feel comfortable. And yet the sex stores are doing pretty well, aren't they?
They seem to be. It's hard to know what's underneath. One of them, unfortunately, a large one, just filed for bankruptcy. There are, you know, tons of companies who are making money selling vibrators.
Yes.
I think in some of the, what I would call more of the mainstream categories, things are doing well. Retail in general, obviously, is having a very hard time. So there are many, many direct-to-consumer businesses where you might get a box of toys or supplements to your sex life that you recommend or that sex experts recommend to you. So we're moving a lot of the conversation direct to consumer and out of retail. And what's important about that, we started the conversation talking about language, is the voice and the message and the words that these companies use are much more accessible to women.
Exactly. And we need to make it okay and fun. whether you have a partner or whether you don't have a partner. You know, one does not need to give up one's sexuality because, you know, for varying different periods of time, there is no partner. So, Lisa, hello, welcome. Are you there?
Hi, yes, I apologize. I was disconnected. How are you?
We're great. We're great. Do you have a question for either Rachel or myself or a comment?
I guess I was just, it's actually more of a commentary. I've noticed that a lot of the work that's being done on female sexual health has been making great inroads, but do you really feel as though it's going to be able to actually come up there and compete with all the branding and the agenda that with men's sexual health?
What do you think? Do you think that we are going to be able to compete with all of the men's sexual health devices and advertising? Do you think we have a shot
as women? I think we're making a lot of progress, and I'd like to change the verb from compete to coexist. Because we don't have to have women's products or women's solutions or women's advertising dominate. We just have to have them be part of the conversation and be part of the solution. So can we compete? We have a long way to go. We have a long way to go in terms of making these products more universally available to women. We have a long way to go in terms of making sure that we can advertise. But we're making enormous strides. The place where I see the greatest growth is in the creation of these products and the creation of these solutions. So over the past 10 years, there's just been an explosion of products. We just have to figure out which ones are going to get or which dozens are going to get to the front of the pack. And I don't think we'll get to more equality between the sexes, if you will, until women have a lot more options that they can use to enhance their sexual experience.
And I think also, I think for women, it's more than the product. You know, we are, and you know, Rachel and I, we were talking about this at the beginning of the show, that there is an emotional quality. I mean, not that men are not, you know, emotional, but that there's certainly an emotionality for us as women that is a given. Unless you're just wanting to hook up, and then none of this really is relevant at all. You can just hook up, have sex, either have orgasms or not have orgasms and say goodbye and get, you know, go on to the next hookup. But I think that for the majority of women, there needs to be this emotional connection. We need to be able to be rested. We need to sleep. We need to at least feel that we like our partner. We need to be able to put aside time to prioritize our sex lives, our relationships, in order to then to be able to really enjoy and have good sex. I mean, do you agree, Rachel?
Yeah, I think it's important to understand the actual complexity of the female sexual response. So if you look at the medical model of female sexual response, it's a complex intersection of different systems.
Right.
Physiological, psychological, social, behavior, contextual. So the complexity that you talk about is actually real and scientifically based, that there are all these different systems at play that need to be working in the right direction for her to be in the mind space, in the physiological space, in the emotional space to really enjoy it. That doesn't mean she has to be firing on all cylinders, but it really is important to understand if you looked at the male sexual response system and the females side by side, we are not looking at apples to apples.
No, we're certainly not. I mean, with men, certainly men who, you know, come to see me and who have issues with erectile dysfunction, I mean, the first question, of course, we need to rule out physical problems like a blockage in the heart. And that is so frequently, and it frustrates me so often, that the urologist or the family doctor will not look at that possible relationship between the erection difficulties and perhaps issues that are going on or not going on in the heart. Rachel, we have another caller. Hello, Ken, hello?
Hi, how are you?
Hi. Welcome to the Ask Beattie Show. You're here with me, Beattie Cohan, Avretos, and Rachel. Cheryl, what is your question or comments?
My thought here is, why wouldn't the venture capitalists, who are men, which men are the ones that constantly want to have things happening, why wouldn't they want to invest? It sounds like a win-win situation. If you invest and the women are feeling more vibrant to do this, then aren't we happy too?
Ken, you're singing from the same hymnal. I agree with you. The way you lay it out is incredibly logical. It's a win-win for everybody. If she's happier, her partner's happier, everything works better. Unfortunately, it's not a linear conversation that we're having. It has to do with societal norms. It has to do with culture and religion and overall comfort with sexuality. So if you look at it purely as an economic argument, which is certainly one way to look at it, the lack of investment doesn't really make sense. Just to give you a sense of the difference in size. So 31% of men have erectile dysfunction. So, and we're looking at businesses that are generate billions of dollars worth of revenue a year. The statistic that's often used for women is that 43% of women at some point in their lives have sexual concerns and difficulties. That's 40% more. The female market for that right now is minuscule. It's, at best, if you roll everything up, it's a couple hundred million. And if you really stretch it, it's a billion. It's not billions and billions. So the math makes sense. I can't explain why we haven't made more progress. And again, there are some investors who are seeing the light, if you will. And I'm not suggesting, I am at heart, I'm a business person. So you should invest in businesses that you think will make money for your investors. And many of these businesses are big enough, important enough, and solve important enough problems and solve important enough needs that they could be extraordinarily successful businesses. As well as the point you started with, which is, isn't everybody happier if women are enjoying themselves more? And I think the answer to that is yes. And hopefully we'll get there.
And we will get there. We are going to definitely get there. And thank you so much for your call. You know, I don't know whether or not you know or not, Rachel, but I was the spokesman for a penis pump manufacturing company for a number of years. Now, why I was not the spokesperson for a female sexuality company remains to be seen. But it was
There's still time.
There's still, yes, there is. Hey, maybe we could do something together. But I was on The Daily Show and was talking about the government funding for penis pumps with Samantha Bee. And there was a woman, I believe she was a nurse, and she was talking about how women's health care, of course, is so badly underfunded. So, and my position was, of course, we need to fund women's sexual, you know, health and education to a much greater degree than we do, but that it was always, and I thought, a very important thing to continue to fund, for, you know, Medicare pays for penis pumps. So guess what happened after the show, whether it was a coincidence or not, because this went viral, it was a whole to-do, here we were talking about sex on The Daily Show, Medicare stopped funding penis pumps.
So I don't know if that's forward progress or backward progress, but at least somebody was listening.
Somebody was listening. And of course, you know, we have a long, long, long way to go when it comes to funding women's health and Planned Parenthood. Of course, it's a whole other
discussion.
It really is.
And one of the things we should keep in mind when we're talking about male satisfaction and female satisfaction is the lack of it doesn't result in death. These are lifestyle improvements. These are important. They're important for relationships. It is different than making sure you're treating cardiac care and preventing heart attacks and diabetes. I'm not suggesting that it's not important, but there's a difference between life-threatening diseases and not life-threatening diseases. I would call the female sexuality and male sexuality pieces relationship-threatening as opposed to life-threatening. And I do think that's a distinction. But if you are going to fund lifestyle enhancements for men, then you should, in fact, fund lifestyle enhancements for women.
No, exactly. And yet I'm going through the various different patients that I treat in their 20s, in their late
20s. Which is just really
and
disturbing.
I'm hearing, I'm not, of course, actually hearing the voices, that would make me
that'd be
psychotic. That would be a definitely a different problem. But the lack of conversation, the lack of satisfaction, and certainly the lack of frequency. And that is something that I think is much more of a lifestyle relationship issue that these people have difficulty talking talking about with their partners.
Yeah, and there's really exciting research that's been published that literally says sex is good for you. If you look at these studies, they say that a frequent, whatever that is, satisfying sex life has a number of physiological benefits. So it doesn't just feel good, it's good for you.
Absolutely.
And I would like that to be much more part of the conversation.
So what do we do? What do we do to get the word out about all of the new products, the new innovations, the wonderful health benefits of frequent, whatever frequent means for, you know, a person or for a couple? What do we do?
The biggest transformation to me would be getting the large, essentially media companies, to change their policies so that on Facebook, on all the, you know, the two or three big companies that control what we have access to, that there's some sort of public outrage to say, make your policies more welcoming to products that help women. So I think if we were able to get the word out, a large part of that is the result of putting pressure on the media companies to say, we want to hear about this. We want to know what these options.
See, I'm surprised that because there is so much money to be made, that the men, who for the most part are the venture capitalists and the CEOs of all these large corporations, aren't jumping on board.
The other thing to think about when you're looking at it from an investment perspective is, because it's such a complicated category, it's been hard for many of these companies to have what they call successful exits, where these investors get a huge return on their investment. It becomes a little bit of a catch-22. How do you know if you don't invest?
Right.
And if you don't invest and support it and do all the things that you do for the other companies that you invest in, how do you expect it to be as successful? So it becomes a little bit of a circular argument, but there's tremendous evidence to lay out the economic equation that supporting companies that provide important products and services that women are clamoring for, that they will result in a strong financial return for these investors.
Are they clamoring for them?
Women hear about them, they are clamoring about them. I always joke that when I would have the opportunity to speak about my product or the products that I work on in public, whether it was 10 people or 1,000 people, mm-hmm. when it was a venue that they were comfortable with, delivered with language that they understood, it was like you felt like you were at a rock concert and people were trampling, mm-hmm. trampling you to get to the product. And I see this over and over again. When women are able to hear about these products through the right media in a way that they're comfortable, and the right media might be different for other people, mm-hmm. often in not one-on-one conversations, but one on 1,000 conversations, that they are so excited and there's such demand and money changing hands, women buying these products.
I would absolutely think so. I mean, so that there is good news. I always like to leave everybody, my patients, my listeners, my friends, with good news.
The world is looking up in this space for sure, with the brilliant inventors, with the brilliant, passionate entrepreneurs. And while a lot of the conversation that's going around now, to your point, is on the negative side, the idea that for a variety of reasons, women are more comfortable using their voice, and hopefully will continue to be, they can also use their voice to ask for solutions and demand solutions in these spaces.
And I think that maybe that would be a great, great message for all of the women, and of course the men who are listening right now, is that if you were having some issues, you want to discuss this with your physician, with your primary care physician, with your gynecologist, with your urologist, and then come up with an action plan. And to not just put this on the back burner and to feel that nothing can be done, because, you know, from my perspective and my experience as a clinician and, of course, yours, I mean, this has been your business, your field. This is what you've been eating and breathing and living for so many years, that there are solutions. It's just a question. It is a question of, as I said at the beginning of every program, to acknowledge, address, and resolve as best as one can the things that are getting in the way of your life, your relationships, and also your sex life, right?
Amen.
No, it's true. So listen, Rachel, can you believe that an hour My friend has literally come and gone.
Flown by.
No, I want to thank you so much. And I love what you're doing. I love the good news. And there's a lot more good news to come. And I'm going to have you come back and when your book comes out.
I would love that.
And we can talk more about all of that. And I want to thank you all for listening as you do every Monday live from 3 to 4. And there's a couple of messages. And, of course, this song says it all. You need to love yourself and love each other. And I'll talk with you next week. And have a good rest of the day and a happy Thanksgiving. And goodbye, everybody.